Hello and welcome to the debrief for our Between Ghosts of El Paso game, which we called Echoes in the Night, I believe.
That is correct, yes.
Thank you. This game has been super fun. We have had a ton of fun and we are very excited to chat about it. But before we do, I'll say hello, Jason. Welcome back.
Hello, thank you for having me back.
Yes. I'm going to let you go ahead. I sent you kind of a list of questions. You can ask those. You can ask other ones. And then we're going to ask you about the game because we always love when we have the creators of the game to come and ask them all about the game. So
absolutely.
I'll let you go ahead and take us off from here.
Yeah, so we did our two-shot of the Between Ghosts of El Paso, which is a setting drift of my game The Between, which normally takes place in Victorian-era London, but this is one that takes place in post-Civil War, immediately post-Civil War El Paso, Texas. And we saw demons and ghosts and bad guys that we only got to glimpse, but never. We probably won't get a chance to really. We may not learn too much more about them, sadly. And lots of scares. It was a really good time. I guess the thing that I am going to open with for you all is, well, at a basic level, like, what did you think of the two shot? How did it go for you? But I'm also particularly interested to hear how it was. Maybe like different from what you're normally accustomed to playing, like, especially if you're more accustomed to, like, say, D&D or something like that. So, whoever wants to go, take it away.
Yeah. Good questions. Let's start with what did we think of the two shot? He calls it a two shot because we recorded this in two sessions.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah.
It's a couple of episodes
worth. Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's going to be five episodes. Yeah.
I think it's five episodes.
I loved it. I thought it was super fun. I love a good spooky setting. I've been looking forward to playing like kind of an Old West kind of setting because, like I said at the beginning, I haven't gotten to play in that setting yet. So I thought the game was very well thought out and cool, but we'll get to that in a minute. But I had such a good time with it.
Yeah, the setting was great. And of course, this goes for... any of the Brindlewood games, but just the fact, like, mechanics wise, it lent itself by its mechanics to some really well fleshed out, like, even the NPCs I remember that were introduced at the very beginning, and I think Miranda had the most NPCs, but even so, I remember even in the first episode we were talking about the NPCs, and I'm just like, man, we've just come up with these, and, you know, they're automatic or whatever, but they already have personality and they feel like actual people. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I was just going to say that, like, I agree 100%. Like, the system itself really lent itself to the story we were telling. And it was just really fun and engaging as a player, you know, like getting those, like the way that it was broken up, like the way you play the game. I liked it. I liked the fact that we had these moments, I think it was, am I thinking of the dusk phase or the dawn phase, Jason, where you kind of have these scenes before you get back into the actual kind of the game itself?
Oh, well, so it that kind of takes place in a few different places, but the in the dusk phase, you set up the unseen and then you do the night phase where you have the unseen bouncing back and forth between the hunters and the unseen, which I think we did the dog in Dallas and then we did like the desert or something.
Yeah, we did like the rain coming. Yeah.
Desert wilderness something or
the
other.
The rainstorm or something. Yeah.
Yeah. But I just loved that. Like, I loved having those moments to just kind of have little scenes where the pressure was on, but it also wasn't, you know?
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the story as like a whole because I feel like it's been a while for us as a group since we played something very like spoopy. I think the last like scary one we did was when we played
10 Candles.
10 Candles.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which feels like forever ago for us. I don't know how recently that was on our feed, but So it was nice to play. So they definitely like was intense. Like it felt like every role mattered, you know. Mm-hmm. And it was really good.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it a lot.
Fantastic. Well, I'm glad everybody had a good experience. Does anybody have any particular parts, like favorite parts from the story that stood out or anything that like you want to highlight, I guess. I have a couple, but I'm curious what everyone thinks.
I mean, I was just going to jump in first and say that mine is the entity was kind of cool and distinct, you know? Like there was like I listened to the first episode when it came out this week. And it was just kind of fun listening back to like the intro of the first three victims, and every single one died differently, you know? Like there was the common thread of the corset like being there on a mannequin at each murder site, but they all had a different like mode of death. Like one like basically got crushed by the corset, you know, and all their guts came out, and another one was like stiff, and another one was like cut by whalebone. So it's just kind of cool. It was like a good setup and really got me involved in like you know, what was going on.
Yeah, that one, that particular threat, the corset, is probably the most horror forward of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole game has like lots of spooky elements because it's, you know, it's called Ghosts of El Paso, but they're very much more like, most of the other threats are very much more like in a traditional sort of ghost story mode, you mm-hmm. know, where it's all about mm-hmm. like, what ties this ghost to the world? What's their tragedy? Like, what's their story? You know, this is the one that's like really, really malevolent mm-hmm. and like malignant.
I
you know?
Like malevolent.
Yeah. 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 But, so it's fun. It's fun to slip into the middle of a campaign because it really like changes the tone of the campaign a little bit. You know, it's like, suddenly we're having this, you know, but I also, you know, for me, what I really love about that threat and what you all added, because and the way you all played was really additive to this, was that threat. I love I love the Red Rock Cantina and Dance Hall as a setting. I think it's such a cool setting. It has so many fun set pieces and elements and mm-hmm. just little details and then using the paint the scene questions to invite the players to sort of further flesh out like what this saloon looks like was really, really fun. That's just was a really big highlight for me.
Yeah.
I think a point to your question about how is it different from other things we've done. Same thing with Brindlewood Bay, obviously, when we played it, but no other system we've done between those two, beyond those two, I should say, has a really like paint the scene
invites the player in
mechanic in it. No, yeah. they don't do that. And I personally love that because then it's just like we get to put our spin on it. And so therefore no two versions of the same setting are going to be the same setting, which is so fun.
Which also like goes into the solution, right?
So, that's true too. Yeah.
You know, yeah. I definitely like that part of it. I think honestly for me, I think I said the same thing in Brindlewood Bay. I don't remember, but My favorite part was really just coming up with the theory of like what was actually going on. That was just my favorite part. Like I just love being able to pull everything together at the end and make it make sense. Like,
and this was a fun one too. Didn't we settle on, wasn't it like,
the Devil's Bride? Yeah.
The devil was looking for a partner.
That's right. Yeah. And the Red Rock co-owner, what was his name?
Dave.
Terrible. I wrote this. I can't remember.
Diamond Dave.
I co-wrote it, I should say. Diamond Dave being kind of like intimately involved. I've run the corset probably 5 or 6 times in total, and I've never had Diamond Dave like be like the villain of it. Yeah, it was really cool.
It's cool.
Yeah, super
cool. That's
fun.
It's always cool. That was one thing I wanted to ask at some point was like, how has this been run differently? And what are some of the solutions people have come up with? Is I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
But yeah, I said it during our discussion with Brindlewood Bay, where I wasn't sure that the fact that the story doesn't have a definite conclusion wasn't going to be a letdown for me. Because obviously, I'm a writer. I like things having conclusions. But like, it really surprised me in Brindlewood Bay. So I wasn't as surprised in this one when I actually really enjoyed that particular aspect of it. Just like coming up with it. It doesn't feel cheap like I would have expected it to. Because that was one thing I was really worried about in Brindlewood Bay. But in this one, I wasn't because I'd already been through a game.
Yeah,
like this
a lot of people are. Like, you know, as you might imagine, I hear this a lot. Like, mm-hmm. people expressing concern that like, well, it's not really a mystery because we're making up the mystery. And my response to that is always like, you know what? When we play a tabletop role-playing game, we make all kinds of conceits at the table, right? Yeah. Like
we make up literally everything.
Yeah, like we have magic systems even though we're not actually doing sorcery, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I'm not sure why mysteries should be any different than that, you know? And indeed, I think it actually leverages what's really good about the medium of role-playing games that no other medium can do, which is collaborative storytelling, you know? Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, it works perfectly. Like, that's a great way to put it. And you can basically think about it like you are the detective, you know, like it really helps you feel like you are the detective.
And you are solving a mystery, right?
Exactly.
You're still like being really deductive and putting the puzzle together, even though like it's, you know, not something that existed, you know, prior, I guess, but.
Right. It's a flexible puzzle.
Yeah,
in real life, when a detective is trying to solve a case, there is no definite answer for them until they actually prove that it is or isn't the
truth.
Talk
about it. Yeah.
We're just rolling dice to see if it's the truth. So
that's exactly right. Yeah.
And let's be honest, if you've been a GM for any length of time, you've let the players come up with how the thing goes.
Exactly. Yeah. I know.
Yeah. I've definitely done that in certain stories. Like there's been a lot of stories that I've run where I'm just like, I don't have a definite answer for how this ends. Like, I want you guys to come up with the answer. And if it makes sense, it makes sense. You know, like it made sense within the context of the world that we've been put into. And I think your game just has a slightly more structured
it's
way
just structure
of doing
around
that.
It really
kind of takes you behind the GM table in this case, you know, like this would just be something that would normally just be happening in the GM's head.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
You know, without the players knowing, but in this case, like the players know, and it doesn't take away from it at all for me. Yeah.
Any other favorite moments?
I did really like when Susanna added at the end that her tattoo changed that's something that we came up with at the very beginning her like character creation. So that was nice.
That was really that was good.
I love it when we can include little bits of character creation lore into the actual story in these one shots because it's so hard to include all that stuff in. But I just love it when we're able to fit that stuff in.
Mm-hmm. I really loved the two scenes that were related to like the dark stuff happening in the background. So we had that kind of short little clue scene related to like the railroad coming through. And then they had a little bit of a scene at the end too, which was a lot of fun. Even though we're only doing it in one shot, it's kind of cool to like think about the story as like,
it sort of teases the bigger possibilities. Right.
For sure.
Like if you're doing a full campaign of the game, that little stinger scene is meant to be exactly that. It's meant to like, you know, it's the MCU at the end of the movie scene, you know, it's about like bringing you back, right?
Yeah.
It's like getting the players excited for something, you know? And all of our games have that. Even Brindlewood Bay does now. Brindlewood Bay didn't used to, but the newest edition of Brindlewood Bay has that built in as well. And like
very cool.
It's all like this idea of like, how do we make the role-playing game experience more cinematic just in general, you know, and to kind of get people excited. So, I'm glad that resonated.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I really like that the sort of not exactly villain kind of got what they wanted. You know, like an antagonist, I guess you would call her. I like that we had to give her what she wanted.
Yeah, Lady Hargrave like, Steele. Yeah.
I love that a lot.
Yeah, she was great. That was also another interesting aspect compared to other times I've run the corset, in that Lady Hargrave Steele was also much closer connected to the solution as well. That is not normally the case. Normally, she's kind of just there as like a... Really, she's kind of just there as like a different angle of investigation. Like, here's somebody who knows about these objects, and so maybe we can pump her for information, you know?
Cool.
But here she was like really like kind of part of it. But again, that all kind of came out because of just the different story elements that we had in play, and it made sense, you know?
Yeah, the different characters, yeah.
Yeah, the different characters.
We like involving our NPCs. In fact, we had the inevitable,
you know? Yeah, it was,
And you guys are all so suspicious of NPCs after what I put you through.
Yeah.
That's true. I love the moment of when my character initially comes into the saloon and is trying to piece it together among these other three who, of course, he has no idea. And then the moment when pretty much the entire crew sees him get the drink and they're like, what the heck are we witnessing right now? And it's just all the, like, just in general, all those tiny little kind of funny comedic stuff in the midst of all the awfulness. Like, because if you balance that well, which I think this one did, it turned out so well, because we weren't like, oh yes, this is a comedy. No, it's not. We're interspersing with the comedy so that the non-comedy hits even more.
One thing that I would have loved if liked to have seen if we'd had more time is I really wanted to know more about the inevitable and the little boy that was in the house.
Yeah.
I wanted to know what that was.
You know?
If it had gone on. If it had gone on, yeah. I do have a hunch, I will say, I do have a hunch that he would have eventually, like, maybe at the conclusion of the mystery, would have gone and said, all right, human woman or whoever, I'll take that back now. or this person, whatever. Not that he would say that. He knows that that would be giving it all away. Or not all, but a lot. Be like, why are you referring to me like that?
I mean, I just think the little boy is just like a perfect little hook for later in the story, but obviously this is a one shot, so
yeah.
But I thought it was a fun angle.
It was a fun angle, and it would if this had been a campaign, I definitely would have like tried to, you know, while leaving space for Wesley to figure out like exactly how to make it fit with this character, I would have still like I would have tried my best to like kind of, you know, sort of shape and nudge put that kid, and particularly putting. Yeah, into the story, and also the sort of insufferable woman.
I loved her.
Woman. Hannah's character was like living, getting them involved. Yeah. She was actually an echo of a character that exists across all of our game lines. There's a woman called Patience. she's in the regular between, or no, Constance is in the regular between, and then in the future in my game Public Access, there's one of her descendants called Patience, and then we have a Temperance.
Yeah. It's all in the same family.
That's
line.
A lot of
they're
fun.
Everywhere.
They're all like nods
they're
to each
everywhere.
Other for sure. Yeah, like
that's super fun. I love that.
Okay, well, the next question here says, what did you think about the system? But I feel like we've talked about that a fair amount already.
Oh, yeah.
Seems like everybody liked it, so that was good. so maybe like kind of piggyback or dovetailing with the what did you think about the system, do you have any questions for me about the system? Is there anything that you want to know about behind the curtain, so to speak, in terms of that, or just anything about our games that I'm happy to talk about? Yeah.
Well, the first question we usually ask is, what gave you the idea for this?
Ghost of El Paso wasn't actually my idea. I co-authored this with Daniel Qualls, and I wrote The Between, which is the game that it's part of, but Daniel wanted to do The Between, but like in this Old West setting. And he was originally doing it without our involvement, meaning the Gauntlet and myself. He was just doing it as a kind of a fan project. But I really liked where it was going. And so my business partner at the time and I, we approached Daniel about going ahead and just making it an official part of the Between line. And
cool,
so,
cool.
Yeah. And so we, you know, we kind of paid for the, you know, for the rights to it or to his work. And we kind of, and then I spent a lot of time like editing it and adapting it to fit with The Between in London. So the original version of the game was not like, it wasn't like an exact mechanical, like, you know, like duplicate of The Between. It was kind of its own thing. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to make it really, really closely tied to The Between. And so we revamped the playbooks to make them fit. And we also just, it's co-authored in the sense that like, a lot of the characters and the threats, I went back through what Daniel had done and very much like
made it in our house style, like changed a lot of the language and changed a lot of the characters and stuff to make it really fit with what I consider the Gauntlet House style, because we are, our games have a really particular voice, you know? And so we did that. And so, yeah, I didn't have the original idea, but I loved the idea. And so, the original idea, the London version of The Between, the mothership of that, of The Between, so to speak, that was just because I wanted to make a game that was, I wanted to make the Penny Dreadful role-playing game. And so,
okay,
there you go.
So
I did.
That's fun.
Nice.
That was, I started work on that a long time ago. Actually, I started work on The Between even before Brindlewood Bay.
Oh, wow.
It came out after Brindlewood Bay, but I originally wrote Brindlewood Bay because I was having a design issue with The Between. I wasn't sure how the mystery system was going to work. And so I wanted to write a smaller game to try out the mystery system that I had kind of formulating in my brain rather than rewrite The Between over and over again. And so I created this like kind of smaller game to try out the mysteries. And that's where Brindlewood Bay came from. But then Brindlewood Bay ended up being its own thing, you know? And so...
its own massively popular like game.
Its own thing, which is exciting. But the two games have always been like in conversation with each other, you know, like Brindlewood Bay stuff ends up in The Between, Between stuff ends up in Brindlewood Bay and so forth. So yeah.
Very neat. That's cool. I love that. I think nice. If I remember right, our GM for Brindlewood Bay was telling us a little bit about that.
Yeah. It's got an interesting, from a design standpoint, has a really interesting history, I think.
Totally.
Yeah. Very cool. If you had to pick, I'm going to switch gears here on you. If you had to pick a favorite playbook from Ghosts of El Paso, which one would it be?
Ooh, what a good question. Well, I don't play ever. I'm only ever a keeper or a GM. But but the ones I like to see in action, I guess, are the ones that I think are really fun. I've done about 3 campaigns of Ghosts of El Paso, and I've seen all of the playbooks in action. And I think the one that I love when it's really, really singing, when the player is really in the, like, doing the thing over the course of a campaign, I think is The Lost, which is the one that Hannah played. Yeah. I
really like that one.
When you get, like, especially in a campaign, you get that really interesting TikTok of... I sinned, you know, or I'm a sinner. It's like, but God saved me. So now I'm on the straight and narrow again until I've done just enough to go back to being a sinner, you know, it's such a fun character. And also it's pretty directly inspired by the priest character in Deadwood, who is like such a fantastic character if you've never watched Deadwood. And so, I really love that. But honestly, I think all the playbooks are really good.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
They all have something to recommend them, right? You know, there's Marshall has this really fantastic move where they can have this like person who they keep in the prison, the jail cell, who's always there, named Del Sol, but he's like clearly a sort of weird figment of the Marshall's imagination or something like that. Oh. You know, so that's always really fun.
That's,
you know,
really fun.
And there's all the really fun backstory stuff with the Inevitable, and then the Mr. Perdition stuff with the Charlatan. I mean, there's so many. They all have like something that's really fun to play with, you know. So yeah,
most definitely.
But I would say The Lost. Yeah, if I had to pick.
What about what's your favorite story that you've written?
Oh, like the
module,
you mean like,
whatever the word.
Oh, which threat or scenario?
Yeah,
for,
threat. Yeah.
Scenario. Oh, yeah. Well, I only sort of like wrote 2 originally for Ghosts of El Paso. I wrote the corset, and I wrote there's one called The Blue Boy, and that one's really fun. This one involves a little bit of like real world American history. During this time period, people were obsessed with the painting of the Blue Boy. It's a famous painting of this like little boy in like kind of a blue satin get up, you know.
I think I only know it because it's an Animal Crossing. Just gonna.
Oh, it is an Animal. Yeah, it's one of Red's paintings. Yeah, in Animal Crossing.
Yeah.
And it's a really famous painting, and during this time, it was like,
I know the painting. I just had to look it up.
Yeah, it was really heavily commercialized at this time. Like, people were really into it. And that's so they would buy, like, prints of it. They would buy, like, figurines. They would buy, like, all kinds of stuff. It was, like, a whole thing. And that's so crazy. People had, like, so much Blue Boy crap in their house and stuff, you know? And so, you know, like, just, like, tchotchkes and junk, you know? Yeah. And so this threat is about a ghost that is taking advantage of this rich lady's obsession with the blue boy by presenting as the blue boy.
Oh.
Yeah. And
That's so fun.
Yeah. And so it's a really fun one. It's a lot of fun. But my favorite of, it's not the one, I didn't write it. I mean, I edited it and added to it. But my favorite of the ones that are available in the game, I really love Ghost Riders of Sawtooth Ridge. That one is so gotcha. Fun. It's the one that we were originally going to do, but I changed my mind at the 11th hour, or I offered something different at the 11th hour. But it's really quite fun because it's the one threat that, of all of them, it has the most feel of like a classic out on the trail Western, you know, so like people traveling from place to place, like, you know, going to campsite, going up to the hill, going to the mine, you know, and they're kind of investigating this mystery. And it just has like such a classic, like, yeah, like sort of out on the range, out on the trail Western feel. And it's great. Yeah.
I can say this now, actually, but just for the listeners, anyone who remembers in the first episode, I used the Death's Morbid Tongue move, but that wasn't my original pick for this. I was actually going to have basically this supernatural horse
that could
do everything cool.
Which would have been great for Ghost Riders of Sawtooth Ridge, actually.
It was, yeah, but that's the reason. Yeah. But I changed it beforehand, and that was just so funny, because I'm glad we did what I did. But thank you, Jason, by the way, for being like, by the way, this is not really going to matter.
Not in the corset, no. Because the corset just takes place in one building, right? So your weird horse wouldn't have. Although I love role-playing that horse. As a keeper, I love role-playing that horse. That horse, I can make that horse so creepy. Like,
nice.
It's a remarkable bit of, like, if I do say so myself, of role playing, because how do you role play a horse, right? But like,
right.
It's fun
for sure. You know? I have to say, like, I'm kind of glad we didn't do the Sawtooth Ridge one, because that sounds like it would have been a little too similar to the other one shot that we did that was Western themed, which was also very much like traveling around, going
to
different places.
Did have a lot of travel in it. Yep.
Well, and I could tell this group was super into the horror elements, and so that's why I wanted to offer the corset, because the corset is the straight up horror one. Yeah,
for sure.
As far as atmospherics at the end there with the whole ritual, I was totally into it. I'm wow, this is good.
I liked it a lot. I thought that was definitely perfect for us and very different from other things that we've done before.
Yeah.
Well, are there any other questions that I've got one more to ask here, I think, based off this list, but do you have any other questions for me?
Susanna kind of half asked this earlier, but what are some other ways people have solved this mystery before?
Yeah, I'd have to remember back to like the specific solutions. I'd have to think for a moment. But what the kind of flavor that we normally get with the corset is that the corset is like some kind of like jealous entity that was jealous of the people who it killed for some reason, either because of their beauty or because they were in love or something. That's a typical, pretty, that's kind of a common, that vein of solution is pretty common. We've had a solution once where like the corset was trying to like weirdly like trying to be reborn in the world the entity was, and it got kind of like, so it was sort of like doing different things to sort of like convince people to, like, it was one trying to be like reborn through like people in the cantina. You know, the solutions can go in so many different directions, I suppose. You get like lots of different things. Oftentimes the solution, the ultimate like resolution ends up, it almost always ends up being some kind of ritual. That's pretty common throughout, like some kind of ritual to deal with the object itself.
Yeah.
But I've never had it be like where Diamond Dave was really like, he's almost always just like kind of a really tertiary character normally, but he was really like central in this solution, which I thought was pretty cool. So
that's cool.
That's really fascinating. Nice. Yeah. Ours is pretty darn different. It's always fascinating when you get to play like the same scenario with different people. I've only done it like once or twice with some mysteries that I've written for Monster of the Week, but it's always fascinating just to see how like vastly different people will take a story.
I've run the starter Brindlewood Bay mystery guide overboard. I've probably run that, I don't know, on the low end, at least 30 or 40 times, right? And like, and it's always really different. Like, there's always like really distinct like aspects to the solution, right? No matter how many times I've run it, I always, groups just, because players latch onto different characters, they latch onto different themes, they latch onto different ideas. And so it just takes in a different, you know, a different direction, which I think is really cool. You know?
Yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I know there's about a bazillion questions I want to ask you about like writing for tabletop RPGs. But I don't want to ask them all here because that's just me going like, we're working on an RPG right now. And I want to pick your brain.
I'm here. You can pick my brain. I don't care. Yeah.
I'll probably have more questions later on. But what made you want to write your own systems?
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's a good question.
What's your history with tabletop RPGs and what made you want to write your own system?
Yeah. So my history with the hobby started when I was really young, actually. I was like 10 years old,
oh, wow.
which is like 35 years ago. my very first role-playing game was the Marvel Superheroes role-playing game. The advanced one that came in the box with the blue and the red book. And I convinced my dad to buy it for me at this comic book shop. I knew it was a game of some sort. I had no idea what it meant or what it was. And indeed, I probably spent like 2 months just reading the books, having no clue what I was supposed to be doing, because it was pre-internet and I was pretty young, and I just had no context to understand what this game was. Like, I just didn't, and I'd never heard of Dungeons and Dragons, and so like I just had no context. And so an older kid came over and knew what role-playing games were and showed me how to do it and ran Marvel Superheroes for me, just 1v1. And and I was hooked. I was totally hooked. And I even remember the moment when I was like, wow, this is for me. And I was playing this villain character and my character was trying to break into a jewelry store or something. And this kid who was being the GM, he was like, you know, he described the jewelry store and the, you know, the door and everything and the window. And then he goes, what do you do? And I was like, what do you mean, what do I do? He's like, well, just what do you do? And I was like, well, I don't know what you mean. Like, am I supposed to like look at this chart or is there dice or something? Like, I don't know. Is there something on the paper I'm supposed to know about? And he was like, no, just tell me what you do. And so I finally like figured out, he just wanted me to say what my character did. And so I said what I would do. And then he's like, okay. And then he described something. And then we did, you know, and it just kind of rolled from there. And I was so hooked by that experience.
That's
like
awesome.
Because it just felt like, to my mind, the possibilities just seemed so wide open. It was like, my goodness, you could do anything, you know. And
yeah,
and so that really hooked me. And so I played role-playing games, oh gosh, like more or less nonstop from that point on, you know, through high school and stuff. I took a break in the early 2000s, so I kind of missed D&D 3.0 and all that. My main system prior to that was, I was a 2E player. I mean, 2E was my main system, you know, for most of my childhood. So I kind of took a break in the, like the first 10 years, like 2001 to 2013. I didn't play role-playing games. I did board games in those years, but I came back because of indie role-playing games. That's what kind of drew me back.
Cool.
And I was really drawn by like Fiasco and games like that. And so, I founded The Gauntlet, which was just a little face-to-face group in Houston at the time. But we were really excited and we were playing games a lot. And we played games, you know, once a week, turned into twice a week, turned into three times a week.
Oh my gosh, wow.
Turned into podcast, turned into, you know, like it just kind of grew and grew. And then in 2018 was when we like first started like properly publishing things, just little games that our community had written, and it became my full-time job in 2019.
Awesome. And,
that is amazing.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
The first couple of years were a little rough, like money-wise, like kind of building it up and getting it going. but everything's great now. So, you know, and we're just full steam ahead. We just released a brand new game yesterday, the Silt versus role-playing game, Silt versus role-playing game, which is doing great. And so, yeah, it's all just humming along.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
We have very similar aha moments when it comes to like role-playing games. Yeah. Yeah. how I got into like role playing games was like I was super into Avatar The Last Airbender, and like I still am, but I was like super into it when it first came out. And I started role playing on well, I found the forum on, it was like an Avatar The Last Airbender forum, and then I saw this tab called role playing, and I'm like, oh, what's that, you know? And so that's how I kind of got into like role playing games, was role playing Avatar. And at some point someone kind of like DM'd me and was like, hey, like I see you have like potential, you know, like you're a good writer, but like you're just kind of like, you're not doing like anything, you're just kind of repeating like what all the other posts are saying, like do what you want to do, you know, like tell the story how you want to tell it, like don't be afraid to do things, you know. I was like, I could do things. You know? So kind of like the same vein there. Yeah. Like, what do you mean I could just do things? You know? What do you mean? Like, what do you want to do? So yeah, it's kind of a similar aha moment for me.
For certain people, presumably us, it like it really it really like tweaks a part of your brain where you're like, oh, like I love, like there's something about just the wide open possibilities of this like that really resonates. It's, you know,
it's funny for me because it was the opposite. I was on the opposite end. I've always been the GM, and I think it was partially I had learned about role-playing games. I was vaguely aware of D&D before, but someone on like this girls page from my college, I was asking for podcast recommendations, and someone mentioned The Adventure Zone. And I was like, that sounds interesting. Mm. And so that was my first experience with like a role-playing game. And as I listened to it, I was like,
so you've come along fairly recently then. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, no, I'd had no experience in, I wish so much I'd gotten into this earlier in life, because I would have had so much fun with it.
Whenever.
Well, I didn't actually play role-playing games until we formed this group. Yeah. I had role-played, like done like narrative role-playing in the past, but not like role-playing games.
I learned later, after we launched the show, my dad was a huge D&D nerd back in the day, but he never told me about any of that. So I had no idea. But I always loved it from the GMing perspective, because I've always been a writer, right? And so I really enjoyed in college in my screenwriting classes getting to like work with other people to tell a story. And so this was just like this moment of listening through and going like, oh, that'd be really cool. I bet I could do that.
Yeah, I actually don't have that's a really funny thing though, is like for me, I had no creative writing experience at all. Like Brindlewood Bay was the first thing I ever wrote, you know?
Wow.
And, yeah.
And you like, really hit it out of the park, didn't you?
Yeah, I know. I was like,
naturally talented.
Let's keep that going. But I mean, like, on the one hand, like, I was discovering something about myself. Like, oh, I didn't know I could do this. Like, that's great. That's awesome. But on the other hand, I think I kind of always knew I could do it. Because when you run games and you are being creative, right? You are a creator. You're doing creative things. I just had never really, like, sat down and put word to, you know, to word processor. You know, like, I've never really done that. And so, and my writing style is still very, like, I don't sit and just, like, write. Like I think and then once I'm usually waiting for like one particular part of the game to fall into place, and then when it does in my head it falls into place, then I sit down and I knock the whole thing out in like no time.
Nice.
I wrote public access in like 2 days.
Wow.
I wrote Brindlewood Bay in like 2 days. I wrote The Between, which is a more involved game, but I wrote it in like 2 weeks. But that was just when I actually started writing. Like I'd been thinking about them for a long time, but when I actually like, okay, now is the time to write. When I sit down and when that time comes, it all flows out really fast. So yeah.
Yeah. That's how I am. Yeah.
I feel like it was very similar with how we've been doing with Somnophobia. Like we kind of came up with this idea, and then like 2 days later we had this like whole,
a whole server with all the stuff.
Most of an entire
in it.
System.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's how Vincent Baker does too. Vincent Baker, who designed Apocalypse World and many other games, he has a similar process. He's like, I think about something for a long time, and I'm just waiting for that one piece that's been eluding me. And then once I have that one piece, then I just sit down and it just all pours out. And that's how it went for me too. Like Public Access, which is the game, the second to last game we released, an analog horror thing. It's been received pretty well. I had been thinking about public access probably since 2014. Like it's a concept that had been kind of floating around in my head for years, and it's a really personal game in a lot of ways. But until I kind of figured out the one little design element that unlocked it for me, I didn't, you know, that was what made it go from a thing I'd love to do someday or a game I'd like to make someday to, oh, now it is a game I'm making, you know?
Yeah, so, that's cool.
Yeah. It makes me feel better that other people write like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just not one of those people who can like sit down and like, you know, do X number of words per day or finish this. I just can't do it.
Not,
like, no,
not my
it
has style. To
happen. If it doesn't happen all at once, it's not going to happen for
that's
me.
That's Susanna's so, style.
Yeah, you know. No, I tend to, right now I'm working on outlining a book because it just smacked me in the face. I wrote a book when I was in high school, and I realize now that it'd be really cool if I did it as a fantasy book. And so I'm like working on reworking it as a fantasy book right now. And I've been writing like a ton, but yeah, I tend to write more over time than I think either of you guys do. Mm-hmm. I tend to write like, you know, a couple hundred words a day, and then
like the other week I wrote 15,000 words in 1 week.
Oh wow.
Yeah, that's how I do too. Yeah. I'm like this is the week I'm working on this and then that's when I do it. Yeah. And,
No, I'm an overtime person. I can't do it all at once. I've tried and it doesn't work. Not for me.
Well,
for me.
It sounds like you guys are more pantsers and I'm more of an outliner. If you've ever heard the term between like what's the word? Plotters and pantsers.
It's not that I don't plan. It's that my planning is in my head.
Yeah, that's me too. It's just all
that's fair.
Yeah. But I can't do that. Yeah. I have to have an outline or I'll get lost.
Oh, yeah.
If I don't outline, I will get lost in the middle of writing the story.
Usually I'll have like fragments of pieces, and then it takes me a while to sort out like what order should those pieces go in, and then I'll feel like something's missing, and until I find out what's missing, and then once it clicks together, I'm like, there we go. Yeah. And then I'm good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the same thing. And it's all about like, and there's like a scope and scale thing too, right? Like sometimes like when I'm writing a scenario for a game, like like Ghosts of El Paso, I was not the principal writer on that, but I did write a couple of the scenarios, and those I thought about for like a couple days and then wrote, you know, like they were just smaller in scope. So they just needed a couple days of batting around in my head before I sat down and actually do them. But I like to take lots of walks, and I read lots of books, and in both of those times, those times are my like coalescing times, you know. It's like, okay,
yeah,
I read so many books, I read like 50, 60, 70 books a year, and I'm always filing away like things.
Yeah,
I can
the word
use.
I like to use is percolating.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
it's like percolating, you know. It's like in there, it's going, it's just not quite ready yet.
I love to read a chapter of a book, go take a walk, and on my walk I'm like thinking about game applications or how what I just read might be useful to a game, either a game I'm running or a game I'm writing, you know. So
that's awesome. Yeah. I do a lot of the same thing with writing fiction. But yeah, I often tell people, I've done a couple of like talks with kids, as a writer. And I always tell them like, if you want to be a writer, you need to read a lot. And it's not true for everybody, but I think it's true for the vast majority of people. You need to be consuming fiction of the kind that you like.
I tend to agree. Yeah. I, for me, it's like, I think that there's really something to be said about just like understanding the form, you know, like there's, you know, there's something to be said about just understanding how words go together and experiencing different authorial voices and points of view. Right. Because you can never really come up with, I don't think like you can come up with your own unless you understand where it fits, you know, like there are certain readers who I love and I love their voice, or writers that I love and I love their voice, but I know that it's not my voice, you know, like my voice is different, but I can identify theirs. And I think that's important, you know?
Well, you probably still learn something about knowing theirs that helps you with yours.
That helps you figure out yours. Yeah,
that's fair. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, the more you read, the more you kind of absorb how story structure works, you know, like when I've read books about writing, there's a lot of it that I read and I'm like, I kind of know this already, but you've put it into words for me, you know, just because I've read so many books.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And honestly, game design's the same way. Like, but from the game, like, I think one of the things that's really helped us in the Gauntlet is we didn't start publishing games. We started running lots of games. Like, mm-hmm. at its height, when the Gauntlet was just a gaming community, we literally organized probably like 200 sessions a month.
Wow.
Right?
Dang.
Yeah.
Wow.
And,
that's wild.
And that I mean, yeah. And like, I myself, I probably ran like 15 or 20 of those, you know? So like, I ran so many games, a wide variety of games, and we had a community that was so active in running games and talking about games that when we decided to get into publishing, we came loaded with like the practical experience and knowledge of what works at the table, right? Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
Like the reason why I know the mystery system works in Brindlewood Bay is because I've done some variation of that at my table. Paint the Scene, that directly came from just how we run games in the Gauntlet, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's a similar thing. Like, if you're going to design games, I think you should play them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I kind of feel the same way, because like, we started writing our game Somnophobia after we've had 4 years of playing games.
Yeah.
Especially after doing One Shot Mondays, where we've played a ton of different kinds of games.
That variety helps. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it really does. I mean, width is important. I think depth is also important. I think there's a lot of value in playing one game for a long time. Mm-hmm. But it's equally valuable to play lots of different games, you know, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've played crunchy games, we've played rules light games, like everything in between, and it's good to have that kind of contrast.
Yeah, I would always run like lots of little indie games over like one or two sessions, you know, and that but I always had my Dungeon World or my Monster Hearts campaign, right? Like those were always like ongoing and there, so that I could get that depth as well, you know. So you get like you get a little bit
that's
of depth.
That's us with Monster of the Week.
Yeah. Yeah. And Monster of the Week too. Yeah. I would always have Monster of the Week, Monster Hearts, or Dungeon World, like usually kind of like going over a long period of time. So
yeah, and it's cool because of the one of the things that's helpful about playing so many games is we learn what we like and we learn what we don't like. Yeah. So, you know, my two favorite systems are probably Monster of the Week and Urban Shadows.
Oh, okay.
Like those are the two systems that with my brain just clicked so perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've played a lot of other games, but there's little bits and pieces that I want to use from other different games, ideas that I definitely want to include in with that sort of basis of these two games that I like so much that I want to kind of emulate just a little bit.
And that's game design, right? You know,
picking what you like and leaving out what you don't.
The night move in my games, I think the way my games use it is unique, but it is 100% taken from Bluebeard's Bride and Monster Hearts, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I was in the room when it was developed in Bluebeard's Bride, like, you know, and so like I you know, but there's clearly like a lineage there. Like you can see, you know, where it came from. And I think that's important and valid, you know, like I don't think it's absurd to suggest that like somebody should come up with something that's just wholly original like that.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe you can have pieces that are wholly original, but nothing like, new you can't sun. Like,
yeah, I was going to say is like everything's probably gonna have been done before. Like,
or some version of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You're going to have your own bent on it, but you know,
yeah, I think my mystery system is pretty unique, but there's still lots of indie games that had like similar ideas, like emergent mystery ideas, right? Which I'm clearly influenced by, you know. So it's hard to find like truly. And when it does, like I think Ten Candles is a great example. Yeah. Like Ten Candles has a mechanic that is like really quite novel and like and no one had seen before. And
Spell.
Have you heard Spell?
I don't think I know Spell.
Tell them what Spell is.
Tell him about Spell, Hannah.
I have it right here on my bookshelf. So the whole premise is that you can basically like cast any spell you want, basically. But how spell casting works is that you have a bag of Scrabble tiles and you roll to see how many tiles you can pull.
Oh, I've heard of this. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you like cast the spell by spelling something out with the tiles that you pulled.
Yeah,
it's
that's
great.
Cool.
Probably
see, that's great.
The
yeah,
most
like
unique that. Game that we've played and one of the ones that I've had the most fun with. Like we had a blast
it was great.
Playing that game. It was so
It was
cool.
really fun.
Yeah.
It was one of those games where I was the one running it, and it was one of those games as a GM where you really can't plan anything.
Yep.
Like, mm-hmm. literally, like, you can't plan anything, and you always have to be like when someone asks, like, can I do this? You say yes.
And you get the tiles for it.
You know? Like, yes, and, you know?
Yes,
like,
and,
if yeah. you can spell yes, it, it, go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The holy law of yes and. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it was nice because sometimes we've played systems where someone will ask, like, can I do this? And I'll be like, well, let me check the rules, or no, like, you can't really do that. So it was nice to always say yes and.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Well, it looks like the last question of the questions I was provided is, what sort of fan art would we like to see for this arc of El Paso? I already have an idea. I'm going to say the chess match.
Oh, yeah. That was a lot of fun. I loved that.
Oh, that was fun.
I also just loved how innuendo laden it was, but, you know.
Yeah, that was so funny.
We're talking about the art, Andrew. I don't know how you put that. I don't want to see that in our
Well, I don't
want to
see
you.
That, but I mean, like, this kind of like conversation between the two of us was just so much fun.
I know what you meant. I know.
Yeah.
I also think something that also like something that incorporated a lot of the like kind of snake and garden of good and evil like kind of vibes of, you know, that there were, because there were several times that that kind of got woven in both in the unseen and also like in the performance on the stage and like different things like that would have been really
fun. I agree.
This whole game did have a rather Hieronymus Bosch feel to it. I would love to see like us doing the ritual with like Mr. Perdition standing in the background.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Watching,
that is exactly what I was going to say.
I do want to see, of course, you know, this is a pretty much for anything, anyone we do, like character art
of
all the characters, obviously. But I also want to see Temperance. I want to see, what does Temperance look like? And what does Billy look like? Billy the kid.
I also love, like, this is me just like tooting my own horn, but I like how I wrote Billy in for like list of NPCs as Billy, comma, the kid. It was just funny how that whole thing evolved. Because back when we were like doing that first episode, Jason, you were like talking to Wesley about his character, and you know, you were talking about how he was, or Wesley brought up he was like a loner,
solitary.
Like he was living
solitary.
And you're like, oh wow, that's interesting. Yeah. And then like minutes later, you're like, hey, you have this kid. It was great.
Yeah. I want to see like a wide shot of the Dusty Jackalope. Like I want to see Miranda's saloon.
Yeah. What is Bernadette. It? Oh, and Marcus Penrose.
And Flapjack.
That'd be great. Yeah.
And Flapjack. Yeah.
Flapjack.
This is kind of a funny like meme thing, and I can't think of what show the meme is actually from or the GIF. But it's like this guy standing in a doorway with a broom and he's like touching the shoulder of someone who's like crying over a toilet. I don't know if anyone knows what I'm talking about.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. But it would be funny if it was Wesley's character Jack with the broom touching, you know, Billy the Kid. Like, they're there, you know, like with the broom because he can't actually touch him.
He can't touch him.
At the end.
Like Billy's just crying, you know, and he's in the doorway like with the broom at arm's length, funny. Just touching him with like the bristle end, like there child, you know.
I think I'd like to see art of the scene where Miranda almost got choked out by corset,
totally
taking air out of the
that was cool.
That was a good
it's
scene.
It's funny like I know the system is like supposed to be like very cinematic. There were a lot of like really cool, like very intense scenes of us talking to people. There are not as many sort of like big, wide, exciting sort of scenes that.
Well, it's a different kind of cinematic,
exactly,
right?
Yeah.
It's
that close in stuff. I definitely want to see the confrontation, maybe like a still shot of the confrontation with Miranda and the random troublemaker that shows up in the saloon, and she just walks over and is like,
"Oh yeah,
I'm gonna dump this drink on your head. Get out of here."
Yeah,
I had so much fun with this character.
That'd been another fun, that would have been another fun follow up in a campaign.
Yeah,
sure. Like,
yeah, for sure.
Because I kind of felt like there was some interesting tension between those two characters, mm-hmm. like between yeah. Miranda and that character, who we never met that character's name. We never learned his name or anything, but it would have been.
But he could have easily yeah. come back with beef or just in general, and like who knows where that would have gone.
I liked Miranda and Marcus's relationship as well. I thought that was definitely the beginning of.
I mean, I love playing Marcus. Marcus is one of my favorite side characters in the game. I love playing Marcus. So. Yeah.
I would have had yeah. a lot of fun with a character like that as a GM.
I think art of Reverend Potter getting the dance tokens from the ghost would be
yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a great too. Scene. That was a really good scene. Yeah. Yeah, that was great.
You know, something I'm realizing about this. This one shot in particular is that it might make like a really good comic because it is a lot of intense talking scenes, but that's okay for a comic. You know, comic can be action and stuff too, but I just feel like that lends itself very easily to that kind of story, you know?
I know we want the whole, if it isn't a comic scenario, I know we wanted the whole ritual at the end, but if we're going for a closer frame, it would be the moment where my character is tying the corset on and like that moment when he comes up in her ear and goes, you know, one day you will welcome me. Like, you know, you're going to wish for your end. I'm like, oh, that would be so cool.
That was so cool. I love the relationship between Death and the lady.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, that would have been fun. That would have been another fun, ongoing campaign.
Especially because we kind of semi-finally like made her win, you know? So like now he has to be sitting there with her, you know, not really being touchable and having to deal with it. That would have been a lot of fun. Yeah.
So a fun fact for people who like, it was kind of, she was actually kind of an Easter egg for people who know the London Between really well, because the organization that the characters work for in the Between is called Hargrave House.
Okay.
But it's never revealed who established Hargrave House. Where did Hargrave House come from? It is established that Hargrave House is very old, like centuries old, but Lady Hargrave Steele's appearance in El Paso is, for people who know, they realize like, oh, she's the founder of Hargrave House.
Cool. That's cool.
Because she's immortal, and she's clearly got like a, she keeps talking about her little like, you know, her little, you know, paranormal research organization back in London. That's Hargrave House.
That's awesome. Nice. I love that.
That's cool.
I did have one funny thing I wanted to mention. It didn't get to happen like in an episode. But like in the very first episode, Andrew, your character, in his like opening like speech, he said that he was selling land out east.
Did I say east?
And
oh no!
I was waiting the whole time for an opportunity to be like, as Reverend Potter, be like, well, I don't mean to pry, but isn't New Mexico like north and west?
Oh, no. So
it's definitely
but
west.
But it never happened. It's funny because I never got to say that.
It's funny because like the listeners probably picked up on that too. And Andrew will just literally say the wrong word sometimes and not catch it. Like my brain will think I said
it's
one.
It's okay. It's funny. It was really it's so funny. It plays into the whole con.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, yeah.
I like it from a narrative perspective because it's just like he's run so many cons he can't remember which one's which.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if that's correctly, I don't think I said it out loud, but I'm pretty sure that's why I made you mark suspicion because you said back east.
I thought it was just in general. Like, I thought it was just like people were like, okay, like he's what? Yeah. He's selling land?
It's okay. Yeah. It's okay, Andrew. I was the one who was actually supposed to be like Death, and I misquoted because it wasn't even in the Bible.
Hell has no fury like a woman scorned is not from the Bible.
Which is so funny because me as a Christian human knows that is not in there, and yet I'm just like,
it's actually a pretty common misconception. A lot of people think it actually comes from the Bible, so it's not like it was just funny because you're literally Death.
But like before now I knew that, and yet in the moment I was just like, I need a segue to open
this world it is in the Bible.
Maybe, yeah.
Maybe it is. There you go. Maybe it is.
Well, you know, it's the this is the fun of role-playing games as a format.
Oh yeah,
right?
Yes.
You know,
that's true.
You know, you have to kind of it's all improvisational.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, I don't have anything else, so.
I think I'm good too. This has been a lot of fun. This is one of our longer ones. We just really enjoyed talking about this. It's always really cool when we have the actual creator of the game to come on and chat with us. Like, that's just awesome. I'm
happy to do so.
So thank you so much, Jason, for coming on. I really look forward to playing some of your other games in the future. We will definitely have some time to play it, to play some other things. I think we've got so many games that we want to play.
We have many of them. Yeah.
Do you have any recommendations? I'll say, we've talked a lot about your Gauntlet games. Do you have any recommendations for any other systems you might give us? Just a...
Gosh, I play so many things, and I have played so many things. I don't know if you all have had a chance to play Monster Hearts yet, but you definitely should.
Literally the last one we did.
We just did.
Okay, good. Yeah, Monster Hearts is probably, like, that's the game that I wish I'd written. Like, I love Monster Hearts so much.
Yeah.
It's a big influence on me and a big influence on my design, so I really, really strongly recommend Monster Hearts. If you want something that's a little bit more... under the radar, but that is incredibly fun and I think would work pretty well in your format. That is a game called The Society of Dreamers. And this is a game that also a big influence on me and my design, but you play a group of people in Victorian times who have become aware of these entities called the Nemesites that invade people's dreams. And you go about basically trying to, like, find evidence of the Nemesites, and in some cases you can even dive into the dreams of people to get your hands on the Nemesites.
That sounds
right?
useful for some that things sound, we're working
that
up.
That sounds similar to other things, actually.
Yeah, so it's a fun game, so I recommend it. It's good fun. It's got some really interesting systems, like it's got like little subsystems that you play with in it, and it's cool. Really cool.
Very
so.
Cool.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. That's been like a question I've been thinking, like, I might start asking, like, anytime we have like a GM or a game designer, I was like, what's the game you'd recommend? So thank you so much for joining us. This has been super fun. We had a blast with
this.
Thanks
for having me.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to, we're recording this so far, is it in the distance? I can't wait to hear people's reactions to stuff.
This episode comes out on January 8th.
Wow.
Okay, yeah, this is amazing. Yeah.
It is currently November 1st, by the way.
Yeah.
Yes.
Alrighty, y'all. Well, thank you so much for joining us. And we will be back in 2 weeks with a new game in the Light Side system. We are super looking forward to that. So, goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye, guys. Bye.